This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. Ringgit and Cents on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, it's 9:36 a.m. and time for Ringgit and Cents. I'm Melissa Idris sitting in for David Chu this morning, and we're joined by Lim Soon Heng. Morning, Soon Heng.
Morning, Melissa.
So today's show, you've got the millionaire teacher back again, right?
Yeah, you remember him. Canadian high school teacher in Singapore. This time we're talking about chasing investment returns.
What do you mean by that? Like going after high ROIs, return on investments?
Yes, but who doesn't like to see their investments take off? You know, invest a small amount and then reap big sums over a short spell.
So that's the greed factor, is it?
Maybe so the human factor.
Human factor. Let's hear what Andrew Hallam, the millionaire teacher, has to say about this impulse.
A lot of people don't do well in a market simply because of the fear and greed traps. What are these things?
Well, sometimes one of the things that people do is when the market goes up significantly, what people often do is they feel really good about that, and then they chase it with fresh money. And some people will even end up, you know, borrowing money to do that. And that's one of the worst things that an investor can do, but it's so common. I'll give you an example. Let's take the Malaysian stock market over the last 10 years. Well, it's interesting because we're really looking at a return on the Malaysian index over the last decade of roughly 250%. I think very few people who had invested, say, 10,000 ringgit in 2002 would see that 10,000 ringgit turn into 35,000 ringgit. Yet, at the same time, this is what the market has actually returned. The average investor, in all likelihood, hasn't made anywhere near that amount for the behavioral reasons that you alluded to earlier. What they typically end up doing is when the Malaysian market rises, they feel good about that, and it might be their unit trusts. To their unit trusts, if they're invested in Malaysian stocks, would rise subsequently with the index for the most part. So when their unit trust or when their Malaysian stock market increases in value, a lot of people end up feeling good about their fund and they put more money into it. When it drops in value, people become pessimistic and fearful of their fund, so they either sell or they just fail to put fresh money in. So what's typically the case, and I would make a guess just based on academically statistical evidence on how average investors typically do when they're investing in a given market. My guess, it's just my guess, but I'm probably fairly close here. My guess is that with the Malaysian market having seen a growth of 250% over the last 10 years, I would guess that the average Malaysian investor would be lucky to have made half that return, 120% over the last decade. Yet the market itself increased by 250%. And again, it has to do with when the market goes up, people feel really good about buying more. When the market goes down, they feel pessimistic. They won't add more money, or they sell parts of their assets because they think that the market is performing poorly.
Based on what you're telling me, I should follow a contrarian view. So when the market is not doing well, I should be going in. When the market is doing well, I should be coming out.
Well, partly, yeah. One of the things that pension funds and college endowment funds do, and college endowment funds really do perform quite well overall. If you look at the endowment funds of Yale and Harvard, they have low costs, they rebalance, and for the most part, they don't get into playing games. And they don't have investors who are pouring money in or pulling money out. So for them to invest dispassionately is actually fairly easy. You or I, we could invest just like a college endowment fund does, or very similarly. So to give you an example, rather than pulling money into the market and pulling money out, if you had, as an example, a diversified portfolio, and you had, let's assume that part Malaysian stock market, you had part international stock market, and then you had part of a bond market allocation. So fixed income allocation, something boring that pays just a small percentage, but adds stability to the account. Well, at the end of a given year, if the stock market, the Malaysian market, let's assume, had risen exponentially, at the end of the year, you'd look at your portfolio and you'd say, okay, If I'd allocated, let's say you'd allocated a conservative portfolio, 50% in bonds, 25% in the Malaysian index, 25% into an international index. Let's assume that the Malaysian index did really, really, really well during that given year. Well, what most people would want to do is they'd actually want to add more money to the rising asset class. They'd want to add more money to the fund or the market that has just become more expensive. In this case,
asset relocation.
Exactly. What they need to do, rather than add more money to the rising asset class, they need to do just once a year is rebalance it. So they may be selling off a part of their Malaysian market exposure and buying some of the international exposure and or the bond market exposure. Doing something like this allows you to be greedy when others are fearful a little bit, and a little bit fearful when others are greedy, which is Warren Buffett's mantra for making money in the stock and bond markets. So if the markets had collapsed, let's say it's 2008, 2009, and let's assume him saying that you had, let's assume that you had 50% bonds and 50% stocks. And so Soon Hang, the market falls, right?
Mm-hmm.
The stock market falls. All of a sudden, you no longer have 50% of your portfolio in stocks. You may have 30% in stocks because the stock market has fallen. So what you would do at the end of that calendar year is what?
Actually, I should increase my equities.
Exactly. And to do that, you would sell some of your bonds to increase your equities. And you really need to only do this once a year. It's quite simple. It takes about 10 minutes. But it's so counterintuitive. So few people can actually do it. And there have been some fascinating psychological studies done on this in terms of the human mind and why we're actually so reluctant to do this and why we actually prefer adding fresh money to the assets that are actually rising in value. And we're really wired genetically to be poor investors for the most part.
Andrew Hallam, educator, writer of the book, The Millionaire Teacher. Perhaps investing isn't as intuitive as it appears, especially when our emotions, fear and greed, can seep in quite easily into what we are doing. There's indeed truth to the expression, the best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. Coming up, Andrew tells about the time when he himself got caught up in a scheme which sounded too good to be true.
Best for money. BFM 89.9.
This is Ringgit and Sense. Andrew Hallam, the writer of The Millionaire Teacher, has been telling us how we tend to chase rising assets and then flee falling ones. Yet often, this strategy leaves us buying higher and selling lower instead of the opposite. Andrew now shares how he himself got caught once.
Can I get you touch on this Insta cash loans story that you have in your book?
Yeah. Oh, that was a prime example, wasn't it, of something that we were talking about in terms of like chasing a rising asset class. So that was a definite mistake that I made. It came down to, I guess it was probably about 12 years ago, 12, 13.
Yeah, it was also in the mid-90s.
Yes. It was towards the late 90s. A friend of mine came to me and said, I've just found this amazing investment opportunity. He said it guarantees an interest payment of 54% per year. And so I looked at him, and I said, that's crazy.
I think anybody would say it's crazy.
Yeah, 54% a year is a crazy interest rate. And he said, it's guaranteed. First of all, of course, the alarm bells are ringing. And I said, nothing is guaranteed. It's all based on, essentially, the solvency of the person offering the guarantee. So regardless of what company is offering you this guarantee, if that company goes bankrupt, it's all over, which is why government bonds typically, especially if they're from solid governments, tend to be really the safest investments, interest-yielding government bonds. They don't return a great amount, but they tend to be the safest investments. But this thing fascinated me. But at the same time, I knew enough not to actually get into this investment. Well, he did. He'd invested some money, and he actually put about $10,000 in this thing. And by the end of the year, he'd made $5,400 in interest.
Mm-hmm.
So he came to me and he said, look, you were wrong. this thing made 5,400%, 54%, just as promised. And I said, well, wait, you know, you haven't really received your money back yet. You gave the guy $10,000, and he's given you back $5,400. That initial $10,000, it could just disappear. And you've got $5,400 for it. So he says, no, I think you should invest in this thing. And I said, no, I'm not going to invest in that thing. That's crazy. Well, the following year, he had added even more money to this thing. He had added a total of $80,000 to this thing.
That's a lot.
And it paid him 54% a year, year after year after year. And so I actually went down to meet the owner of this company.
Well, in that case, sure that you were not suckered in. I mean, at least you were doing your due diligence.
I did due diligence, but you know the saying that when something's too good to be true, it usually is. And that time and time and time again, it's as Mark Twain says, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes.
So you did your due diligence, and then you met
the
guy.
Well, yeah, you could call it that. I actually met with the guy twice. I met with the company founder twice.
But the thing was, you did your due diligence. You talked to the guy. It sounded really good. So you went in. So that's pretty fair. But at the same time, 54% sounds like an incredible number.
I did. When you talk about due diligence, I found out everything that I could about the company, asked all kinds of questions, was really skeptical. But you're right. If somebody is offering you a guaranteed rate of return, and at 54%, it's a crazy rate, then generally speaking, yeah, if it sounds too good to be true, it is. When someone's talking about guaranteed rate, let's assume that the a Malaysian government bond is yielding 3% or 4%, and somebody offers you a guarantee of double that or triple that, warning lights should go off.
Right.
That guarantee is only as good as the solvency of the company that's actually offering it. So if that company goes bankrupt, how good is the guarantee? And so many companies, I mean, you can look into them. You can do your due diligence. You can do as I did, where you actually sat down with the founder for a couple of hours at a time, which is what I did on two occasions. But still, it wasn't enough. When it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. And the irony is, of course, I ended up investing some money into this thing. And fortunately, not a lot, but I did invest $7,000 into it. I think I received the, quote, interest payments for probably just it was a very short period of time. I certainly didn't get my money back, and then the company ended up going bankrupt. So in essence, what it had done was it had, I don't know whether it had started out as a Ponzi scheme or whether it just disintegrated into one after a poor business plan, but what they had been doing for many, many years is they'd been taking money, fresh deposits from new investors, and paying the current investors, quote, interest.
Right.
But none of us really knew this. We thought the company was very, very profitable.
What I'm hearing is that we may be educated, we may do our, quote, due diligence, but there is some part of it that's really emotional, and that's the part that's really hard, sometimes hard to control when we're investing.
Yeah, very much so. Even more important than the products that we're actually buying is being able to harness our emotions.
If we invested in certain things that which are solid, even though we don't make a lot, if we see with something solid, we'll come off better than we would going chasing after new assets.
I think that you're right. If we diversify our assets, we go with a sound portfolio plan, in all likelihood, we really will end up beating 99% of the people who chase big, high-profit schemes. And it's just through establishing a plan and dispassionately following through on that plan year after year after year, our odds of success are actually quite good.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much. I enjoy it. Well, let's do more of it, Tseneng. Sounds great. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Andrew Hallam, a millionaire school teacher and writer of a book with the same name. His observation: have a sound investment plan and not chase high profit schemes.
That was really interesting, Soon Heng. That was very interesting. But you know what I took away from it was that sometimes it isn't greed, it's actually this kind of kiasu-ness. You know, when you see other people doing well, right? But you feel you're missing out, so you have to jump in.
Yeah, and you jump on the bandwagon, but to your detriment. And then what looked good really suddenly tanks.
And going from a person's investment tanking, we'll move on to a country's economy stalling, is today's financial fast fact.
The term for today is quantitative easing. When a country's economy is stalled or worse, slipping, and interest rates are already low, a government sometimes adopts quantitative easing as an interim measure to kickstart the economy. Through this monetary policy, the money supply in the country increases. Here, the government buys back its securities from the market, pumping liquidity into financial institutions. Flush with money, these institutions in turn promote increased borrowing by consumers and businesses. Money in the hands of end users means that there will be more spending, creating economic activities. The Bank of England injected £75 billion into the economy in March 2009, and then later in the year expanded to £200 billion. In October 2011, the bank announced a further £75 billion of quantitative easing and extending the program again in February 2012 by £50 billion, taking the total size of the program to £325 billion. So this is a financial fast fact for today, quantitative easing. If you have a term that you'd like for me to look up, write to ringgit@bfm.my.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Tomorrow at the same time, we've got the property show and Soon Heng will be back with us. Soon Heng, who's the guest for tomorrow's show?
Well, he's from the National House Buyers Association and the show will be part two of the discussion on rehabilitation of abandoned properties.
Okay, so the property show tomorrow at 9:30 a.m. on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Ringgit and Cents on BFM 89.9, the business station. Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.